From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Today, stories and science from the never-ending human quest for healing and wholeness.
I see this as the beginning of a golden age in medicine. I think as we understand the full spectrum of infectious causation of cancer, we'll be able to prevent a lot of them, maybe 50%, maybe more. Might be able to prevent almost 90%.
What if the autism, instead of being this massive problem to be fixed, instead of shutting life down, what if this autism is the gateway to the greatest adventure of our lives?
Her cells have been around for the biggest landmarks in medical history. You know, they went up in the first space missions to see what would happen to human cells in zero gravity. They were used to help develop the polio vaccine. The list just sort of goes on and on and on.
When I was at my lowest, alone in an alley, another man's blood on my jacket, craving the absolution of crack, Hanuman came to me. Not happy little Hanuman who might let you play jump rope with his tail. Mine had fists of ill will and steel wool for fur, and he came from the version of the Ramayana where Rama is a crackhead and Hanuman is his formerly rock-smoking sponsor.
For years, evolutionary biologist Paul Ewald has been trying to storm the gates of medical science with one claim, that most killer diseases are caused by germs, not genes. Although human genome research is the hot ticket today, Ewald says that these days research is focusing on the increasingly credible theory that viruses are the true culprits behind everything from cancer to schizophrenia. Ewald is the author of Plague Time. He told Steve Paulson how viruses attack cells.
The virus actually attaches to them, invades them, and then sets up shop in those cells. But instead of producing more virus particles that are released from that cell to infect other cells, viruses will sometimes cause the cells they're in to start dividing. And that way, they're not exposing themselves to the immune system, because our immune systems are incredibly sophisticated at scouting out foreign agents like viruses, recognizing them and destroying them. But if a virus can essentially eliminate most of what's viral and just stay as genetic material inside of a cell and make those cells divide without committing suicide and without having a cap on the total number of divisions, then they are able to last for months or years or decades inside of our bodies, reproducing, and then at some point generating new virus particles that could be infecting a new contact. And so to me, the exciting thing about this idea is first that it turns out that decade by decade, more and more cancers are accepted as being caused by infection, which is actually scary, but it's very good news.
You're saying that a few decades ago, no one thought that cancer, any kind of cancer, was caused by infections.
Depends which kinds of cancers you're talking about. But if you're talking about human cancers, when you and I were kids, I presume back in the 60s or 70s,
right,
the dogma was essentially no human cancers are caused by infection. But starting around 1980, there's been this revolution going on in which steadily, decade by decade, more and more cancers have been accepted as being caused by infection. Until now, experts agree that a little over 20% of all human cancers are caused by infection.
What are those cancers?
Well, the one that's achieved the most attention recently is cervical cancer, and that's caused by a virus for which we now have a vaccine. And so that's illustrating what good news it is to find out that infections are causing cancers, because we're quite good at making vaccines to control infections. We can't always do that, but we often can do that. And so now the two greatest success stories, I would say, in the history of interventions to combat cancer have been discoveries that cancers caused by infection and development of vaccines or other methods to reduce transmission, so that now we don't have the cancers developing because we prevent them. And that's far more effective than trying to rely on anti-cancer compounds that have a lot of bad side effects. Their efficiency is not often very good. You're providing people with maybe, sometimes you can provide them with many years of life, but often it's more of a question of a few months or a year or two. They're very uncomfortable kinds of treatments. So the general rule in medicine is if you can prevent something, it's much, much better. It's the, you know, ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure and worth a ton of not very effective treatment.
Mm-hmm. It's a question of Darwinian evolution, too.
It is.
Because I suppose that if it was just genetic factors, I mean, if there were these malfunctioning genes, they would eventually get weeded out of
the
human
population.
They do
tend to get weeded out. They tend to get reintroduced. Cancer occurs later in life, so the pressure to weed them out is not as strong as it would be if they were introduced early in life, but some cancers are occurring early in life. So you have that role of evolution acting on humans, which tends to be sort of a slow role, but those effects of that selection pressure acting on humans have been responsible for generating some of these barriers to cancer that we've been talking about. But it's very important to realize that one of the most important ways in which evolution is acting is on these viruses. Because if a virus is transmitted, let's say, by sexual contact, and people are changing sexual partners, let's say, every 3 years, that virus, once it infects a given partnership, that virus essentially has to stay viable for another, few years if it's going to be successful. So it has to have ways of avoiding the immune system. And one of the best ways for the virus to avoid the immune system is to live inside of a cell, make it divide, expose very little of the virus to the immune system. So the fairly shocking outcome of all of this thinking is that even though we don't know the full scope of infectious agents that cause cancer, we can be pretty sure about how many of them are transmitted. So they're likely to be transmitted by sex and actually by kissing as well.
You're saying we get cancer from sex?
Well, indirectly. That to me is sort of the jaw-dropping conclusion.
So celibate people are not going to get cancer?
Oh, well, then? It depends which cancers you're talking about. Because not all disease organisms that are causing or suspected to cause cancer are transmitted by sex. And it's a complicated story, but disproportionate number of those organisms that are causing cancer are transmitted by sexual contact of one sort or another.
The more partners you have, the more likely you are to get cancer?
Yes. And it's true for cancers that we know about in terms of their causation, that like cervical cancer or head and neck cancer, which is caused by the same virus that causes cervical cancer but is transmitted by oral sex. So there are a lot of things that are, a lot of bits of information of practical importance for many people that come out of this kind of research. But also for many cancers, sexual contact is a risk factor, but we don't know what is transmitted by sexual contact. We don't know why it's a risk factor. So for prostate cancer, the number of sexual partners a man has had in his life is a risk factor for developing prostate cancer. So that implicates some sort of sexually transmitted pathogen.
And you said kissing as well
as kissing.
A risk factor.
Right. So what we know is there are some viruses transmitted by kissing, including the virus that causes the disease that we refer to as the kissing disease, infectious mononucleosis, Epstein-Barr virus, that is known to be causing some cancers and is suspected in a variety of other cancers. And it looks like other pathogens that are at least candidate pathogens for causing cancer are transmitted at least in part by kissing.
How long might this take? I mean, through if the virus is first contracted through sexual transmission, are
depends.
You talking years later?
Yes.
That
generally we're talking about years, sometimes less, but generally we're talking about years to decades. So unfortunately for you and me, the value of this information is greatest for young people just before puberty or maybe just after puberty. If they know this information, then they can make decisions about their, choices of partners and also their protection if they're engaging in sexual contact. That is very likely to reduce the probability of being infected with a cancer-causing virus that eventually causes problems perhaps decades later. So it's a very long-term kind of benefit, but it's something that the sooner we start talking about it, the better off we'll be.
So you're saying that somewhere down the road we might have various vaccines for different cancers.
Exactly.
There might be a vaccine for breast cancer.
That's right. I think there will be. Breast cancer is a tricky problem because the same virus that has been found in cervical cancer is found in about 20 to 50% of breast cancers. And it looks like that virus could be playing a role. It could be just contamination of the breast with that virus, but it's a little tricky because that virus may also be more likely to infect tumors that are already developed. So it could be kind of a hitchhiker rather than an actual cause. And so this is an area of active research. There are two other viruses that have been associated with breast cancer. One is the Epstein-Barr virus that we talked about earlier that is transmitted by kissing. And then another one is called the mouse mammary tumor virus, which is normally causing breast tumors in mice, and it's getting into humans. and we don't exactly know how, but it's found in about a third of the breast cancers that have been studied and not found in many of the normal tissues. So what we're probably going to find, I think, with breast cancer is a variety of different viruses are playing a role. And that makes the whole problem more difficult. It's a little more like liver cancer than it would be like cervical cancer in the sense that it's harder to identify what cause and effect is occurring if you've got several different players.
You might have to have multiple vaccines.
That's right.
Then.
That's right. But what's interesting is the same culprits tend to be turning up in more than one cancer. So if you make a vaccine like the vaccine that protects against cervical cancer, you may get fringe benefits. So clearly now everybody agrees that if you get that vaccine to protect someone against cervical cancer, they've got a lower chance of getting head and neck cancers like cancers of the tonsils. And so we're likely to see these fringe benefits of these vaccines, which change a lot of the discussion that we might be engaged in. If we say, well, should we encourage use of this vaccine if it turns out that the vaccine is protecting against not only cervical cancer but tonsillar cancer and then maybe also against breast cancer, then it means that the benefit of that vaccine is far greater than we would have originally thought. So I see this as the beginning of a golden age in medicine. I think as we understand the full spectrum of infectious causation of cancer, we'll be able to prevent a lot of them, maybe 50%, maybe more. Might be able to prevent almost 90% by making vaccines against what hopefully will be a fairly small number of infectious culprits. We're discovering new ones every 5 years, and so we don't know whether it's eventually going to be 5 or 10 or 15 or maybe 20 pathogens that are involved in cancer. And sometimes we'll get lucky. We'll get a pathogen we can control easily with infection. Maybe sometimes we'll get a pathogen that we actually can eliminate by an anti-infective. And that seems to be the case with stomach cancer. Pretty much everybody agrees that a good portion of stomach cancer is caused by this bacterium that also causes ulcers, this Helicobacter pylori. And what's interesting about this example is if you find a person who has an early stage of stomach cancer caused by this bacterium, and you treat that person with antibiotics, you can cure that cancer. Now, 30 years ago, if somebody said, I think we could cure a cancer with an antibiotic treatment, they would have just laughed you off the stage. But now we know that that's actually true, at least for one cancer. And so my argument is, let's be scientific about this. Let's think about the possible payoffs that we can get, the possible benefits associated with broadening our view, and let's be very careful to carefully evaluate the various explanations, the various hypotheses for causes of cancer so that we don't miss some causes that would be preventable and therefore causes that could give us, if we understand them, a really great advancement in medicine.
Paul Ewald is an evolutionary biologist and the author of the book Plague Time. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Coming up, a family travels to Mongolia in search of healing for autism. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Sometimes modern medicine can only go so far and stands baffled in the face of new syndromes and diseases. It's the case with autism, a condition that affects 1 in 100 children today. There is no known cure. Rupert Isaacson tried everything to help his autistic son.
We were losing him. We tried every form of Western medication we could. Behavioral analysis, pills, creams, diets. But he still didn't speak to us. Spent hours lining up objects obsessively, was completely isolated from other kids, and his tantrums were getting worse and worse. But then, something extraordinary happened.
Rupert Isaacson discovered his son had a special bond with horses. The calming effect was so startling that Isaacson decided to take his family to Mongolia, the one country that combines shamanic healing and horses, to seek out help for his son, Rowan. He wrote about the experience in his book, The Horse Boy, which is also the title of a documentary chronicling the trip. Isaacson says Rowan's first experience with a horse was unforgettable.
I assumed, because of his erratic behavior, his tantrums and so on, that he was unsafe around horses. So I actually stopped riding. I stopped owning horses. And for me, that's not a good thing. I start to get a bit depressed if I'm not around horses. But I thought that was the responsible thing to do. He took himself into my neighbor's horse pasture and chucked himself at the feet of his boss mare. All horse herds have an alpha or a boss, you know, of the herd. In this case, it's a female called Betsy. And he literally just sort of threw himself on the ground at her feet. And I thought, oh, you know, he's going to get trampled. And I was actually creeping up trying to grab him, you know, through the fence to pull him away. But he didn't get trampled. In fact, something extraordinary happened. She bent her head and half closed her eye and began to lick and chew. And if you are a trained horse trainer, if you're a trained horseman, you know what that behavior means. It's like a dog showing its belly. It means I submit to you. You're the alpha.
It's nice to know that the story is going to have a fairly positive ending, but I'm curious about this moment because it was hope for you. Clearly, this was something that you hadn't experienced before, but it's not a cure. And taking him away from Betsy, you didn't experience a complete change in behavior.
No, but what I did experience was when I asked him, because he went to Betsy two or three times. You know, it took that for me to be convinced that this was something I should pursue. And then I said to him, almost rhetorically, you know, do you want to get up? And he said, up. Now, he had what you call echolalia, in that a lot of autistic kids will repeat words that they hear, particularly the last thing that's said, but it doesn't mean they understand it at all. And I thought, well, is this echolalia or what? So I put a saddle on her and I climbed up and put him up and climbed up behind him. And then again, rather rhetorically, just said, well, you know, where do you want to go? Do you want to go to the woods or the pond? He said, to the pond. And again, that's classic echolalia, because repeat the last thing said, okay, but this is something. So I rode down to the pond and this big heron got up and flapped away. And he said, heron. I didn't know he knew that word. And that's when the door opened.
Yeah. Now, this is all wonderful. And you then made what seems to an outsider an extraordinary decision to take him beyond this to a place in the world where horses are very important, to Mongolia. But that, from Texas to Mongolia, that's a big a big move.
Yes. It happened actually with its own weird logic, but you have to understand a bit more about my family background. I sound British, but I'm British South African. All my family in South Africa is very, very diverse. Not all my family is white, and my non-white family is related by marriage, if you can get this around your head, to the last group of Bushmen hunter-gatherers that still live in South Africa. They're called the Klamani Bushmen, and I actually wrote a book about this called The Healing Land. Their culture is entirely based around healing through the use of trance, and I was familiar with this. I'd seen it at work through the course of my life many times. That wasn't a huge mental leap for me. But the year that Rowan was diagnosed, and the same year that he met Betsy, I had to bring a delegation of Bushmen hunter-gatherers over to the USA to go to the United Nations. I'm a human rights worker and a journalist, as well as an autism dad. And they were losing their land to make way for diamond mines. We brought them here to make a protest and kick them off on a land claim. Some of the guys who were on the delegation were trained healers in their culture, and they offered very casually to, in inverted commas, work on Rowan a little bit. I said, sure, why not? You know, I mean, the worst thing that could happen is nothing, right? Because it's a bit of song and it's a bit of prayer. You know, there's nothing that could hurt the child. And to my amazement, for the 4 days that they were with him, it was tantalizingly like having a normal toddler. A lot of his obsessive behaviors went away. When the Bushman went home, Rowan fell back into the profundity of his symptoms again. But I couldn't help but notice, okay, he's had this radical and positive reaction to the horse. He's had this radical and positive reaction to these healers. I'm trying many other therapies, and they don't really seem to be getting anywhere. In fact, his speech therapist had given up on him more or less the week that he found Betsy. So I thought, what would happen if I took him to a place that combined these two things, horses and healing? Because I could go to Africa tomorrow, but that's not a horse culture.
Yeah. Well, I can understand how you would be enthusiastic about the idea, given your background. Still, it seems like a big step. One day you are having difficulty getting through the day with a child who has severe behavior problems. The yeah. next day you are on a plane flying, well, from Western notions to Outer Mongolia to the other side of the earth.
Yes, I know. The thing was, it was an absolute gut feeling. And I think there was something else at work as well, which was that there was this sense I had. When we first got the diagnosis, most of the professionals that we spoke to, with the best of intentions, basically told us our lives were over. You know, they said, you're going to have to live your life according to a schedule on a fridge. And there will be no travel, there will be no adventure, there will be none of these things, you know, and you just have to accept this. And that's not practical for me, because that's how I make my living. And also, it's not practical for us as a family. Yeah. So I thought, hold on, maybe they've got this backwards. What if the autism, instead of being this massive problem to be fixed, instead of shutting life down, what if this autism is the gateway to the greatest adventure of our lives? What if this is the gateway to the most beautiful adventure of our lives? Who's to say that can't be true?
So you go off to the other side of the world. When you got there, it looked, frankly, it looked like the backside of Chicago in the film. You must have thought, oh my heavens, we've made a mistake.
Well, I thought that many times in the course of the journey. I mean, I think that many times in the course of my average day. You know, I mean, let's face it, life is not a precise science, is it? Yeah, when we got there, it was sort of, because we arrived in the city, of course, and the city is like this post-Soviet slum. However, as soon as you leave the city, there's no like suburb, there's no sort of zone of farmland before you hit the steppe. It's like the steppe and the wild mountain comes right up to the city, so you're in one or the other.
Is he going to whip me?
You cannot scream.
But you know, your wife wasn't enthusiastic about this. And then the next thing we see in the documentary is you with a bunch of shamans who are beating you.
I know, terrible. And I had no preparation for this because with the Bushmen, I mean, I've seen I don't know how many healings with the Bushmen in Africa. Their way of healing involves no use of whips and things like that. I wasn't expecting to get whipped. I got
and this
whipped.
Was not lightly whipping either. You had
no,
welts.
They left welts on me and Kristen. I know, I thought she was going to divorce me. But it was funny. There was no sense during the course of this that they had anything but our best interests at heart. It's a difficult thing to explain, but there was no sense of, oh gosh, these people are taking us for a ride or they just want to hurt us. Or No, you could tell that these people were doing everything in their power to help us.
And you began to see signs of change.
We did. I mean, in that first ritual, that first ceremony that you described, Rowan turned to this little 6-year-old boy who was part of the groups of families that were there and opened his arms and hugged him and said, Mongolian brother. And he had never done anything like this before. I mean, the most he'd ever done was what you call parallel play, which is where you ignore another child that's in the same room with you, basically. So that child, it was our guide's son. He was called Tomo. And our guide, Tulga, said, why don't we bring Tomo on the trip with us? Because clearly there's something happening here. So in the middle of the first ceremony, we saw a major, major change. And then we got all the way across Mongolia with various mishaps and ended up in southern Siberia, where the reindeer people live.
There they are. How about that? They're teepees and satellite dish.
Oh, my God. It's the reindeer people's teepees. Look, that's where they are. You made it all the way. You made it all the way. I am so proud of you.
You want to ride a reindeer?
We do want to ride a reindeer, yes.
Their shaman, a guy called Ghost, worked on Rowan for 3 days. And at the end of the 3 days, he said, okay, Rowan's going to get gradually less autistic until he's 9. And by 9, you should be seeing him fairly normal. However, the stuff that really drives you crazy, remember Rowan's 5 at this point, the stuff that really drives you crazy, the incontinence and the tantruming, these will stop like now. And
you must have not quite believed.
Yeah, even with the Bushmen, I have seen really effective healings take place of really severe conditions, but you don't normally see the symptoms go away immediately. It's normally a pretty gradual thing. It's rare to have a shaman say something that unequivocal, and I was guarding my heart. My heart was already broken. You know, I didn't want further disappointment. But 24 or so hours later, we were camped by the river at the bottom of the mountain, and Rowan did his first intentional poo and cleaned himself. And we counted from that point to when we got back to our house in Texas, which took about 3 weeks, we counted 6 tantrums of any note. Normally, that would have been a day's worth or half a day's worth. And by 3 or 4 weeks, they were gone. They had just stopped happening.
Happy birthday, dear Rowan. Happy birthday to you.
Did Rowan get cured of his autism? No. Rowan is still autistic. Did Rowan get healed of the dysfunctions that went along with his autism? The physical and emotional incontinence, the inconsolable tantrums, the isolation from his peers? Yes. For us, this healing was frankly miraculous. But perhaps the real miracle was that we went to Mongolia with a child suffering and a family suffering, and we found healing through whatever means. The bottom line is that we took the adventure, and through that adventure, we found a way, both as individuals and as a family, to break free.
Rupert Isaacson is a journalist and author of the book The Horse Boy. He lives in Austin, Texas. Chini Rao never expected to wind up on the streets of Chicago's South Side, a junkie, getting his hit from petty crime. He came from a successful Indian family and attended an elite Eastern college. But experimentation there led to a downward spiral into addiction. At his lowest point, Rao had visions of Hanuman, the Hindu monkey god, who helped him heal his addiction and build a new life. It was a surprising thing for an atheist like Rao. Rao writes about his story in the book In Hanuman's Hands. He told Anne Strangechamps who Hanuman is in the Hindu faith.
Hanuman is a figure from the Ramayana, and in the Ramayana, you have the gods Rama and Sita and the demon king Ravana, who there's a triangle at play there between these three. And Hanuman ends up being the helper of Rama. He's the one that helps Rama to find his wife Sita after the demon king steals her away. In the Ramayana itself, when it was originally written and everything, Hanuman was a kind of supporting figure, and people understood that he was just the greatest devotee of Rama and, you know, that he did all these great things. But as the years have gone on, his significance within Hinduism and within our understanding of the Ramayana has grown to the point now where we have prayers like the Hanuman Chalisa, where it's this idea of Rama and Sita and all of them are gods that came and went, but Hanuman has always remained, and Hanuman remains on earth to help anybody who's in trouble and anybody who's going through, you know, health problems, you know, mental problems, whatever the problems may be, that Hanuman is actually still present. And I remember growing up and hearing that, and my mom was really big into saying the Hanuman Chalisa, and I just remember her constantly saying that, you know, you're in Hanuman's hands, that, you know, that he's the one that can help you, you know, and that's kind of how help manifested for me as I was on the street. That's the role, that's the God that my mind saw, that's, you know, who I felt acting to turn me. It just at times when it doesn't make sense how I survive.
There's a passage early on in the book in which you describe just a little bit of how you found Hanuman or how he found you. And I wondered if you'd read a little bit of it for us.
I found a shortcut to Hanuman by smoking rock. I thought all those Hindu priests with their mantras, pujas, homas, oil lamps, and incense were doing it the hard way. They chanted his name. They prayed to him. But they just didn't feel him the way a crackhead does. Meditation and ritual require learning, years of dedication before you have the skill necessary to even have a chance of luring a god into looking at your road. Succeed, and you might only hook the sleepy-eyed and blissed-out incarnation of your god of choice, because that god is the one most attuned to your peaceful and happy meditation brainwaves. At best, it might rouse itself from a nap and whisper fragments of New Age philosophy, or give a minor blessing to your loved ones. When I was at my lowest, alone in an alley, another man's blood on my jacket, craving the absolution of crack, Hanuman came to me. Not happy little Hanuman who might let you play jump rope with his tail. Mine had fists of ill will and steel wool for fur, and he came from the version of the Ramayana where Rama is a crackhead and Hanuman is his formerly rock-smoking sponsor.
Oh, that's beautiful. When was the first time you saw Hanuman, felt you had an encounter with him?
Wow. You know, in some ways I felt a presence that I would say now was Hanuman. You know, I felt that a bit throughout childhood. I remember that in, you know, just conversations with my grandfather, you know, just feeling sometimes a presence, feeling these things, just also just in the ways in which my grandfather spoke of him. But there was an element, again, in college when I was at my lowest, where I felt these kind of ephemeral traces of something divine that was there, that was looking out for me. But actually physically feeling like I could see him and feel him was when I was on the streets, when I was completely alone. As that paragraph describes it, you know, when I had somebody else's blood on my jacket and I could just feel just the abyss before me and not knowing what was going to come. It's at that point when I was at my lowest that I could really see him.
What was going on that day in particular?
In particular, I think it was, you know, I was high, I mean, just as high as can be. I'd been smoking a lot of crack, doing a lot of drugs. I just mugged somebody, and I was completely alone at that point. My family had disowned me. One of the guys that I ran around with on the street, he'd gotten knifed, and, we had passed in separate ways. And I didn't have anything. I mean, at that point, all I had as company was my own mind. And, you know, I don't know. People have asked me this question before. Did God really appear before you, or is that a hallucination? And I don't know the answer to that. All I know is that it felt real to me. It felt like God came to me at that moment to steer me away from just a certain death and a certain, you know, waste of all that had been my life and, you know, all that my parents had done and all my ancestors had done.
What did he say to you?
Oh, you know, it's along the lines of you're taking the wrong path and that you aren't alone, that I'm here with you and that, you know, let's start to move in the right direction. Because at that moment when I was in that alley, I had this feeling of just being completely alone, completely lost, that there was no hope. And feeling that voice, feeling that presence made me just begin to feel that there was a way out of it all. Mm. And that, you know, my life wasn't all over and that, you know, that I wasn't completely alone. I mean, which is a really powerful thing, which is a really powerful thing when you're at that moment of just when you cannot see any hope, to have that feeling there and to feel it so strongly. I mean, out of that solitude to feel companionship, there's a huge power there.
This was a long way for you to have fallen. You grew up a really bright, promising boy, you know, math contest, got into good colleges, basketball teams, high achieving. And now you were a crackhead living on the streets of Chicago mugging people. What happened?
You know, I think, you know, I had so much success early in life, but I never really was able to fully appreciate what that meant. A lot of it came easy to me. And, you know, I just was doing things, you know, whether it was academically or athletically, it just, a lot of those things, I never had an appreciation for it. And when I went off to college, the biggest thing that was in my mind was this feeling that I hadn't yet experienced all that life had to offer, you know, because I wasn't allowed to date or drink or do any of these kinds of things. I thought, you know, that really my life wouldn't be complete until I could do all those things that, you know, doing well academically and athletically, that it wasn't really all that big of a deal, that there was more to life. And so when I was in college, I wanted to really just blow the doors open on my own experiences and try everything that I could. And it was in college I started to do more partying, to just try different drugs, to just really, you know, push the limits of what I could experience. And I happened to be one of those people that the moment I started to dip into drugs and alcohol and things like that, it just took me down a different path. And in the book, I talk about it as kind of being this battle between the darkness within me and the light within me, you know, described in terms of Kali and Hanuman.
Like an epic battle between these two gods for your soul.
Yeah. And, you know, and the thing about it is that, you know, I mean, I was seeing therapists and things like that through high school because, again, as I'm saying, you know, I had all these great things that, you know, were happening in my life and that I was doing, but I just, it didn't mean anything to me and I couldn't get pleasure out of it.
The place where you finally clawed your way back out of the depths was a kind of a halfway house of last resort, a place called the Oasis. What was it about being there that finally worked?
One of the beauties of the Oasis, you know, and I've been in other halfway houses, I've been in other programs before that. The thing about the Oasis is there was no BS in these guys. They had been in the same incredibly tough situations, but it was a very small halfway house, and it was built on this principle of just that each of the guys, we were looking out for each other, and it was led by a guy who was just bare-knuckle, hard-nosed, wasn't going to listen to any excuses, and he was just full of compassion as well. And I think for me, in coming to the Oasis, I came at the right time because at that point, I didn't have anything else. And I knew what the streets held for me. I'd already gone to the extremes of what you can do there.
In some ways, you were one of the lucky ones. I mean, you were able to pull yourself back out of that abyss. You went back to school. You went to the University of Chicago. You wound up at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. You're now a professional writer. Is Hahnemann still with you?
Oh, yeah. I still... He's still with me. And you know, and the thing is, it's a strange thing. I always have like a Hahnemann figurine that I carry around with me. Mm-hmm. And I still hear that because it's not as if the negative voices that I have within me don't pop up from time to time. It's not, I mean, I've faced some, you know, some really tough challenges in my life since where this book leaves off. Because, you know, you talk about University of Chicago, you talk about the Writers' Workshop. You know, I had tough times there too. I've had tough times in terms of marriage and divorce and dealing with medical treatments for hepatitis C and all kinds of different things. But it's almost as if, you know, I mean, I have that voice that's there that I know as Hahnemann's that constantly steers me towards my better self, towards the better way. And so, you know, when my mind throws up these different possibilities of things that I could do, I know which voice to listen to.
Chinny Rao is a graduate of the University of Chicago and the Iowa Writers' Workshop. He's the author of In Hahnemann's Hands and Strange Champs, but with
Hahnemann G, son of the wind, lord of the monkeys, Rama's best friend. You eliminate illusion and destroy all sin, and you're known as Shiva's incarnation. You're the champion of truth with the thunderbolt body, the mighty monkey god who embodies Bhakti, you're the breath of Ram, Prana Shakti. You achieve victory like the movie Rocky. You carry a club to smash the thugs. You're the perfect servant, the embodiment of love. You're the face of grace, and your heart is pure. You make the whole demon race tremble when you roar. In service of the Lord, you're the demon destroyer, also known as the king of all warriors. Your compassion in action, devotion in motion, with the strength to leap the length.
Coming up, the true story behind the immortal cell line that has changed the face of modern medicine. You can become a Facebook fan of To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website. You'll find a link at ttbook.org. Drop us a message while you're there. We always love to hear from you. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Henrietta Lacks was a poor African-American migrant who gave birth to five children before she died at the age of 30 from cervical cancer. Unbeknownst to her, a sample of her cells proved invaluable to science. They became an immortal line of human cells that could survive and thrive in the lab. The line of cells is ubiquitous in the sciences as HeLa cells, a term nobody thought much of until recently. Journalist Rebecca Skloot spent a decade learning about Henrietta Lacks and brought her story to light in the book The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. She says HeLa cells are incredibly common.
Her cells have been around for the biggest landmarks in medical history. You know, they went up in the first space missions to see what would happen to human cells in zero gravity. They were used to help develop the polio vaccine. They were the first cells ever cloned. Her genes were some of the first ever mapped. Some of our most important cancer medications came from work done on her cells, vincristine and tamoxifen, which are two drugs that most people know somebody who's taken one of those drugs. And the list just sort of goes on and on and on. HeLa cells are everywhere. Every lab that has anything with cells, you know, has HeLa somewhere, probably in their freezers, or has worked with HeLa cells. And they're just omnipresent in science to the point where people sort of forget that they're there.
That there ever was a human being attached to them.
Yeah, and this is something that's really common in science in general when it comes to research on biological materials is, you know, scientists often don't stop to think about where they came from. There are tools in the lab. There's test tubes, there's the fruit flies and the lab mice and the HeLa cells. And, you know, they're just sort of these things that you use in the lab. And I hear from scientists all the time who have read the book or heard me talk and say, oh, my God, I had no idea. You know, I've been working with these cells most of my career and I never stopped to wonder where they came from. Or I just assumed that she'd given permission. I never thought that she didn't know that the cells were taken, that her family didn't know. Yeah. You know, and the story goes much beyond that. Her children were later used in research to learn more about the HeLa cells without their knowledge. So there's this sort of legacy of a whole family being used in research without their knowledge, privacy violations, yeah. You know, at some point her medical records
were released. Well, there's a whole discussion that we ought to have, but maybe we ought to take it a little bit in order. Mm-hmm. One of the things that shocks you at the very beginning is unrelated to any of that. You mentioned it in passing. Your professor in high school mentioned it. In fact, you laugh about it a little bit in the beginning of the book. There are billions of HeLa cells. If you were to line them up, they would, what, go around the Earth?
Wrap around the Earth. Well, there was an estimate that said that they would wrap around the Earth at least three times, and that was a long time ago. So it would probably be more times now. And one scientist calculated that if you could gather them all together and weigh them, that they would weigh more than 50 million metric tons, which is, you know, more than 150 Empire State Buildings. I mean, it's just an enormous number of cells, particularly given that, I mean, cells weigh nothing. So it's sort of inconceivable how many of her cells are alive.
And then you realize that they are all cancer cells.
Right.
There are no healthy cells
of
Henrietta Lacks in existence anywhere.
Right. Yeah, the doctor took samples from her healthy tissue as well as from her cervical cancer, and the healthy ones died almost immediately in the lab. So it's only the cancer cells that live on.
So you began looking for Henrietta Lacks. She is hardly known. Where did you begin to look? How did you find her?
Well, I started off trying to get in touch with her family, her kids, her husband, and they wouldn't talk to me. It took me about a year and a half to convince them to talk to me.
You had a name and you knew where she came from. You knew that it had been at Johns Hopkins.
Yeah. So, you know, since the family sort of wouldn't talk to me, I started sort of interviewing around them as much as I could. So I found her cousins who she had grown up with. I found her some of her siblings who were still alive. And I just went back to this small town in Southern Virginia where she was raised at this tobacco farm and got her relatives to start telling me stories of her as a child. And I sort of started uncovering the story of her youth.
It's a fascinating story in many ways. Mm-hmm. She was part of a large family, but her parents died and she and her siblings were split up.
Right. Yes. She, like her own children, lost her mother when she was very young and grew up, you know, sort of being passed around to different relatives.
It's a big story for a woman who died so young.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. She had just turned 31 not long before her death, and she left five kids, this enormous legacy. I mean, a lot happened in those 30 years.
But then there is this other element of the story, which is that she was poor and black and living outside Baltimore, and she, in fact, had been to Johns Hopkins before having her children?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Into the colored wing of the hospital. It's hard for us now to remember that in 1951, an eminent institution like Johns Hopkins would have had a wing that was only for colored people.
Yeah, and it was one of the few places that black patients could get treated at all. And interestingly, you know, Hopkins, when it was established specifically to treat the poor and black people who didn't have access to healthcare elsewhere. The whole kind of thinking behind Hopkins was that everyone should have access, but it wasn't equal access in the Jim Crow era.
So moving from Henrietta then to the cells that they took when she did go in to be examined, it was a standard procedure to take a cervical sample.
Yeah, or any sample. This was at a point when scientists had been trying to grow cells in culture for decades, and it hadn't worked. And George Guy, who was the head of tissue culture research at Hopkins, would get samples from anyone who came into Hopkins for anything. He also had deals with different hospitals around Baltimore and in D.C., and so he would collect samples from anywhere. And there were scientists like him all over the country doing the same thing. It was
absolutely
standard.
So what was it about these cells?
In some ways, nobody really knows. We know that she had HPV, you know, the virus that causes cervical cancer, and her cell line has many copies of HPV. And some people have, you know, theorized that that's part of why her cells grew so powerfully. And we know that HPV can alter your DNA and cause cells to grow out of control, and that's how they cause cancer. She also had syphilis, which can weaken your immune system and cause cells to grow more powerfully. But a lot of people in the 50s had HPV, had syphilis. Their cells didn't grow like this. So there are some just sort of mysteries still about why her cells grew when none others did.
Let's follow the cells for a minute before we come back to the family. The cells have an extraordinary story in the 50 years since then. They've been involved in almost all of the major research on cancer since 1951.
Yeah, I mean, her cells have been in some way or another around for the biggest landmarks in medical history. You know, they went up in the first space missions to see what would happen to human cells in zero gravity. They were used to help develop the polio vaccine. They were the first cells ever cloned. Her genes were some of the first ever mapped. Some of our most important cancer medications came from work done on her cells, vincristine and tamoxifen, which are two drugs that most people know somebody who's taken one of those drugs, and the list just sort of goes on and on and on.
And these cells clearly still have something extraordinary about them. There must be other people who have cells of a similar nature, but there's something about these.
Yeah,
that...
and there have been other cells that have grown since. I mean, we have other immortal cell lines. It's now possible for scientists to immortalize a cell line, and they could take a cell line from anyone and turn it into an immortal line by changing it with a virus. But there is something just unusual about her cells, the way that they grow in very uniform way, and you can grow them in massive quantities, which is one of the things that made them so useful for science, is that they didn't just grow, but you could grow them in these enormous vats filled with liquid culture medium, and you could grow them. You know, there was a factory set up in the 50s that was growing them to the tune of about 3 trillion cells a week.
It's the family that caught your attention. You said that they didn't want to talk to you at first. Her daughter, Deborah, especially, didn't want to talk to you, having had some relatively bad experiences with journalists up to this point. That changed. Yeah. How did you affect the change?
When I first called Deborah to try and get her to talk to me about her mother and the cells, I had no idea what the family had been through. All I knew was that there were these amazing cells. They came from this black woman that no one knew anything about, and I wanted to sort of find out her story. And I got on the phone with Deborah, and it became clear very quickly that she was really sort of excited by the idea of someone writing a book, because she didn't know anything about her mother either. She was 2 when her mother died, and no one talked about her. And she wanted very much to learn about her, but was also just terrified that I might do something bad to her. So I was the next in a long line of journalists, but also just white people in general, who had come to the family wanting something from them. You know, scientists, there'd been, you know, all whole string of people. So part of what I did was, it was clear from the beginning that what the family didn't get was information. You know, when they first found out about the cells, no one explained to them what it meant for Henrietta's cells to be alive. So, you know, Henrietta's husband had a 3rd-grade education. He didn't even know what a cell was. And he got this phone call one day from a scientist. And the way he understood it was, we've got your wife. She's alive in a laboratory.
Oh.
We've been...
What a shock.
Right. And we've been doing research on her for the last 25 years. And now we have to test your kids to see if they have cancer, which wasn't what the scientists said at all. They wanted to do research on the kids. They wanted DNA samples from the kids to use to do research on Gila. But for the family, they didn't understand that. And they thought that they were actually being tested to see if they had this thing that killed their mother. So her family got sucked into this world of research that they didn't understand, and the scientists never really realized that the family didn't understand. And so they first learned about the cells in the 70s. I came along in the late 90s and still no one had explained to them what a cell was. They knew that she wasn't alive, like that they couldn't go visit her. His understanding of cell when he got the call was that they had her in a cell.
Yes.
So part of what I did in terms of winning the family's trust was essentially just giving them information as I found it. So
everywhere you went, you reported to them, basically.
I would, except that Deborah wouldn't answer her phone. She had caller ID, and she knew it was me calling, and she would never pick up the phone. So I would leave these messages on her answering machine saying, you know, I just went and met your mom's cousin Cliff, and he told me this great story about them when they were kids in the tobacco field. And I would leave these stories on her answering machine. And she sort of fessed up years later that she was sitting there over the answering machine sort of wanting to pick up but being afraid to pick up. But
clearly listening.
But very definitely
and learning.
Listening and learning. And I would send papers, you know, scientific papers and things that I had found, and I would write little notes that sort of explained a little bit about what was going on in the papers. And then at some point, she just kind of couldn't take it anymore. And the suspense of sort of wanting to talk more about it got to her. And she called me and she said, okay, fine, I'll talk to you, but you have to promise that you're never going to hide anything from me. And I said, hey, you know, you can come with me when I do my research.
And she did.
And she did, yeah. So she would come with me to scientific laboratories. And
eventually you took her and her brother to actually visit the cells.
Yeah. So they went to go see the cells for the first time. And at that point, she was in her mid-50s. So this was, you know, almost more than 30 years after she first learned about the cells. And I went in with her and her brother into a lab at Hopkins where this young cancer researcher had, he had read an article that I wrote, just a very brief article about the family and Henrietta and the family being upset. And he had the reaction that a lot of scientists have, which is this sort of shock and feeling personally somehow responsible since he himself had spent his whole career working with her cells and he did his PhD dissertation on her cells.
And he was at Johns Hopkins where the cells were originally cultured.
Right. So he felt a lot of sort of responsibility and just reached out to me and said, if there's anything I can do to thank the family or help them, I would really like to. And so I said, you know, there is something you could do. And it took a long time to even get the family, get Deborah and Zakaria, her brother, to go into Hopkins to see this. That was one of the scariest things for them in the world. Going into Hopkins was like, you know, terrifying. But they did. And I think it was a good experience for them. They got to sort of understand what the cells were in a way that they never had.
Rebecca Skloot is a science journalist and the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 425A, Extreme Healing. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Ann Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.